This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
Ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I'm simply delighted to have as my guest this evening the editor and creator of the government rag, Stephanie Sledge, who does an absolutely fantastic job with it. Today we're going to go back all the way to Tucson to investigate what appears to have been the first of a whole series of faked attacks. In this case, one that may or may not have actually injured, at least killed a judge, it would appear. Stephanie, I'm so glad to have you here. Welcome to The Real Deal.
Oh, thank you so much, Jim. It was just an honor and a thrill to be on your show.
Tell me, how'd you get involved and what gave you the inspiration for creating the government rag?
I woke up one day and I had this urge that I needed to use my writing skills and I needed to use my voice to let America know what was going on. And so I just created a website and called it the Government Rag. And actually, there is a little bit of history behind the Government Rag. It was a printed magazine back around 1920. And so it went out of business. And so I picked it up and took it digital. So,
did you say Princeton?
It was in print.
Oh, in print. I see.
So wait. I took it digital and I've been trying to grow it ever since. And, you know, it's been fun and just has put me in contact with a lot of people, a lot of knowledge. And so I really enjoy it very much.
Well, I think you're doing an absolutely terrific job with it. And I like the format. It has certain old fashioned qualities that I find immensely appealing.
Ah, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And I love featuring your stuff on my site as well.
I got to compliment you for that, Stephanie. That's wonderful. I'm thrilled by that. And I thought I've seen that you've done has just looked wonderful. And I was so pleased when you picked up on the banning of the Nobody Died at Sandy Hook.
Yeah, well, Jim, nobody died at Sandy Hook.
I know. Can you believe I have in my last few blogs nailed the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Chronicle of Higher Education for suppressing or distorting Sandy Hook, blatant forms of propaganda and disinformation, Stephanie. It's absolutely shocking to me.
Wow. You know, and I'll show you right here right now. A good friend of mine and contributing writer, Jack Mullen, he borrowed me your book, and I read it over the last 2 days, and I want to thank you for all the information that you put in here because you helped me as well in my investigation into the Lochner shooting because you brought up points that I need to go back and look at. I need to go back, and I need to look at some, you know, I have more questions now, and so that sparked me to really have a desire to continue the investigation and do more research.
Well, that's absolutely sensational. We're on the verge of publishing a book on the Boston bombing, by the way.
You are?
Yeah, I think you're going to like it.
I will love it. And if you need any help.
You send me your address and I'll send you an inscribed copy.
Oh, I would love it. But even better, if you would like some of my research into the Boston bombing, I would be more than willing to help out. I have so much research. It's just unbelievable.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, here's what we'll do. When the book may be out this week, Stephanie.
Oh, wow.
So what we'll do is when the book comes out, I'll have you come on to give us a critique, okay?
Okay, absolutely. That'd be awesome. Thank you very much.
And we'll bring in, you know, the additional research you have done, anything we may have missed. I think you're going to like it, but I'm very glad to know you're an expert there. Are you from the Boston area?
No, I'm not. I'm from the Midwest, and I am not from the Boston area. However, when it happened, I did my fair amount of research as it was unfolding, and I actually wrote an article. You can find it on thegovernmentrag.com, and anyway, on my bio, I wrote an article, and it's about the Boston bombing, and it's called The Boston Bombing 333 Disarray, and I wrote that, I believe, not more than a week after the Boston bombing, and so I cover a lot of the initial information that was coming out and expose a lot of stuff. So if anybody wants to view that, it's
terrific.
But it was an investigative mindset, so it's a little bit longer than a normal article.
Terrific. Yeah, send me some links. I'll check it out.
Yeah, I will. Thank you.
In anticipation of having you back when the book's available.
Okay, I'll do that.
This is wonderful. Tell me, what drew you into Tucson?
Well, as soon as the story unfolded, you know, it was all over mainstream media. It was coming out on the AP press like crazy. And I took an interest in it because I was watching several channels. I was reading several articles about what was going on out there. And I basically started realizing early on that, you know, there was something strange about the event. You know, a lot of the witnesses' testimonies weren't adding up, nor were they even matching, like from, you know, CNN News to NBC. They were all different. And so the witnesses were having different stories. You know, the shooter, the picture that they initially put up with them was definitely something that I was like, there's definitely something Photoshopped wrong with this. And so it sparked just my interest. I followed it, the story, for a while. And then, you know, I decided that I would like to go out and check it out myself. And so, I did go out there, and I tried to track down many of the witnesses. A lot of people wouldn't talk to me. However, I continued an investigation, went down several rabbit holes out there to find out, you know, what really happened. And so I just decided that, you know, if I'm going to be a journalist, you know, I might as well do my fair share of the work and let America know what's going on. So that's why I did it.
Well, that's fantastic. The Boston book, of course, we have an article by Dennis Camino on the nexus of tyranny, you know, Tucson, Aurora, and Sandy Hook. That is, you must have run across that at the end of the book.
I did. I was wondering, it rung a bell, and I'm like, yeah, that's right. I did read it in the end of the book. So you're right. And I did go through that. And, you know, I had some things that I was going to email you and talk to you about further about the Tucson shooting, but that's why we're here for this interview. And, but yeah, I mean, there was definitely a lot. You could have wrote a whole book just on that or the Aurora shooting itself.
I won't be surprised if you have a lot of information that Dennis didn't have when he authored that. So
yeah.
I'm very, very pleased. Shall we take a look at your first slide?
Yeah, absolutely.
Chance, are we up now? Okay. Go right ahead, Steph.
All right. Well, this is Jared Lee Loeffner, and this was the initial picture that the AP press had put out. And the shooting had took place on January 8th of 2011 at 10:10 in the morning, and it was out in the parking lot of a Safeway store in Tucson, Arizona. And it was reported that Jared Lee Loeffner had gone to the scene that day, and he had, you know, just let loose with a barrage of bullets. And 13 people were injured and 6 people at the time were reported dead. And among the dead were, among the 6 people that were reported dead, there was a judge. His name was Judge Sean Roll. And also a little girl that was 9 years old. Her name was Christina Taylor Green. And she was allegedly born on 9/11/01, the day of the terrorist attacks. And so, anyway, that's Jared Lee Lochner, and that's who the whole event there that I investigated.
Tell me, were you convinced by the end of your research that 6 people actually had died and 13 others had actually been injured?
You know, when I first went into the investigation, I had my suspicions that, you know, if it was a drill, that, you know, nobody had died at all. But, you know, after I did my investigation and just the tremendous amount of research that I did, you know, I was able to obtain 6 autopsies. And as far as the actual 13 that are injured, you know, I cannot be for certain because many of those people would not talk to me. So I can't be for certain that they were actually injured, but I can tell you that I do have autopsy reports that I was handed personally while I was out investigating Tucson. And so, you know, unless somebody can, you know, prove to me that those autopsies are faked, at this point in time, I do believe that there were 6 dead, but as far as 13 injured, I'm not convinced that all of the injured were injured.
Did you actually go to Tucson as part of your investigation?
I did. I actually went to Tucson, visited the crime scene, hunted down many people. I was stalked, harassed, followed, threatened. And so it was what I call 10 days of hell in Tucson. But I was able to obtain a lot of information. I was able to prove various things like the funeral that they, you know, the AP had and the mainstream media had on, you know, was faked. I was able to confront people there at the funeral home, go talk to the church. So I was able to visit Judge John Roll's grave. And so, I did quite a bit of actual physical work into the investigation.
This photograph of Jared Lee Lochner, of course, is bizarre. I mean, it makes him look like he's some kind of lunatic.
Yeah. And, you know, in my opinion, this photograph was photoshopped. It was the first one that they put out. They used it, you know, as far as what I believe they used it for was to, you know, connect the dots of being afraid with gun control because, you know, following the shooting, I mean, right off the bat, they started gun control debates. And so what better way to put fear in the public of a mass shooter than to put a crazy looking person up on the screen? And so this was the first one. It was a few days later that the marshal's office actually released another photo. And it also, I believe, is photoshopped, but it definitely looks more like a real person rather than, you know, like a crazy, deranged lunatic.
Of course, nothing could be more unlike a real person than what we have of Adam Lanza from Sandy Hook.
I mean, oh, yeah, absolutely. They make him look like he's severely on meth and, you know, just a cracked out individual. So, yeah, that also was a staged photo.
Yeah, it's crossed my mind that what they actually took a skull and then painted it to give the rough approximation, almost cartoonish, of the fellow who appears to be a complete creature of fantasy, of fiction, namely Adam Lanza. I don't believe there ever was an Adam Lanza.
And, you know, I thought that about Jared Lee Lochner as well, but I did find some background research into him and some police reports. And so I did find multiple pictures of him, some that his friends claim that, you know, were him. And so, but yeah, as far as Adam Lanza, you know, from the get-go, I had my suspicions that he was just a fake character. And It's interesting that you describe the way that they may have created his picture for everybody, because now that you really look at it, it does look like a skull that they painted. And of course, you know, that's to put fear into the people. Look at that crazy, deranged gunman.
That's right. Subliminally, it would convey something of the nature of death, as a skull will typically suggest to anyone. So,
yeah, absolutely.
I think that some of these psyops are very, very cleverly planned for their emotional and psychological impact.
Yeah, they're all connected. It is. I mean, not only is it just for gun control, there's also the agenda of bringing the mental health industry into it. And so, anyway, that's most of the agenda that I found in the Loeffner case was, and it seems to be continuing through the Aurora shooting, through the Boston bombing, through the Sandy Hook shooting, other shootings as well, but that seems to be also tied to the gun control, is, you know, the mental health agenda.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And I myself have not given it enough emphasis, because they want to use the mental health criteria to deprive people of the right to have access to guns, for example, so that they're creating categories never before known to the American Psychological Association, for example, that are going to be used by the government to deprive even those who are legally the owners of guns of their possession. This is beginning in California of late, according to reports I've got, and it's profoundly troubling.
Yeah, it is very troubling. I don't think that, you know, the majority of America understands how deep this agenda goes. And, you know, there's all kinds of derailments also on the internet, just simply by trying to derail, you know, these types of events by putting, you know, a lot of truth mixed with lies. And so, in my opinion, you know, they just, you know, they've opened up a huge, you know, game for the American people to, you know, catch the ball at. And so people are, you know, at this point in time, you know, I'm hoping are waking up at a tremendously huge rate, just simply because, you know, this is, it's America's falling quickly, and it's things like this that are doing it.
Oh, I agree completely. It's absolutely shocking. And I do actually, I've now formed the hypothesis that the gun agenda is related to the introduction of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the dissolution of sovereignty of nations, because the TPP will create a board of super lawyers whose decisions can override those of the laws of any nation, including the Constitution of the United States. And I believe when Americans wake up to the fact that if the TPP passes, which I hope desperately never comes to pass, but they've been deprived of their own form of government by a duplicitous president of the United States, who's not only, in my opinion, violated his oath of office by subverting the Second Amendment when he swore to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic, but actually taking measures, most of which have been kept secret, including some of these executive orders, which is absurd in principle, because how can the people even know what the law is if they aren't allowed to know what's in these executive orders that are going to even supersede the sovereignty and overthrow the Constitution itself?
Yeah, that's an amazing connection. It definitely needs to be expanded on. And I mean, that right there is, you know, an amazing connection. So a lot of people need to start looking at that.
What got me going on it, Stephanie, was the seeming hysteria of the Obama administration creating one of these fake shootings after another at a seemingly increasing rate.
Yeah.
They have a deadline they're trying to meet. And what's in the offing? The TPP, which actually has these devastating consequences. Anyone who's worried about the New World Order, the TPP inaugurates the New World Order. You'll no longer even be able to know the source of your food. It precludes labeling of genetically modified food. It extends copyrights for corporations. It allows them to disconnect any website from the internet without giving any rationale or reason. I mean, it's truly draconian.
Yeah,
you have a board of super lawyers that can override the sovereignty of a nation. To me, that is by far the most troubling aspect of the TPP.
Yeah, that is definitely the most troubling. That's a wake-up call. That's a red flag. And so people need to really take a look at that. All eyes need to be on that right now, because you are right. And, you know, they find ways to just, you know, try to, you know, get all this stuff moving forward while they distract the nation on things like Sandy Hook and the Loughner shooting or the next sport game or, you know, what have you. And so, yeah, I agree. I mean, that's very, very troubling.
Steph, let's look at your next slide. I think you have some other photographs of this fellow, Jared Lee Loughner.
Yeah, these are different photographs that began to surface after the shooting. And, you know, like, I found them quite suspicious simply because, you know, the initial photos that were put out, he had brown eyes, but his MySpace page had green eyes. And, you know, his high school picture, he has blue eyes. And so, anyway, there were lots of pictures that were on different networks, in different newspapers, on different social sites, that were initially released of Jared Lee Loughner. However, you know, when it came to the actual, you know, processing Jared Lee Loughner, you know, there was no live shots of him. There was no live footage whatsoever, not even during his, at the time that he was going to trial before he pled guilty. And the only thing that we saw after these initial photos were released were then just courtroom drawings.
You know, we had those with Zocher Serenova in Boston, too, courtroom drawings. Friends of his attended the indictment there and his initial plea, and said it wasn't actually their friend, that it looked like someone else. So I've been very, very suspicious about that aspect of Boston. And what you're pointing out here is very troubling all by itself, too. Why should it not be permissible to have cameras in the courtroom?
Well, exactly. And, you know, what I found interesting was, you know, following the shooting, you know, it didn't seem like there was anybody in Tucson. You know, I would have thought that during the time that he was going to trial and he was at the courthouse, that, you know, there would be a truckload of people from Tucson or surrounding areas that would want to be there, that would have their own live shots released on, you know, YouTube or anything. But there was nothing at all that was ever that I could find. On the next slide, I believe, or one afterwards anyway, this slide right here, this was the only photo that I could ever find that was released when he was transported from Arizona to Missouri. And a Missouri news station had claimed that they took this photo of Loughner being transferred to the Springfield, Missouri Federal Psychiatric Prison for his evaluation. And so that's the only photo that I could find where there was actually depicting a real man, you know, and being transferred anywhere.
Do you think that transfer was necessary? It seems kind of odd to send a prisoner out of state for even for a psychiatric evaluation.
You know, it does. And I thought about that, like, why isn't he serving his time in his own state? And the Federal Bureau of Prisons are different, and you can be placed anywhere really around the nation. And he was charged with federal crimes, especially since he allegedly killed a federal judge. And one of the things that I found interesting was, you know, I as I was trying to search for Loughner's identity to try to, you know, find out if he was real or if he was an actor, because there were many people online that were putting out photographs, you know, where they were putting up comparisons that Loughner was, you know, this actor and Loughner was that actor. But I had a trail of somebody that was real, and so I continued that. And you know, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, what they do is they sent him there for a psychiatric evaluation while he was being awaiting trial. And so at first Loeffner had pleaded you know, that he was not guilty by reason of insanity, but over the course of the time where he was in Springfield, Missouri, they forcibly medicated him, and they, you know, at the end of that, then he ended up just pleading guilty and there was no trial. So, and actually he had the same lawyer as the Boston bomber. And, I don't know if you're aware of that or not, but his lawyer was the same lawyer as the Boston bomber.
I don't recall the name of the attorney. Do you recall it offhand?
You know, I was going to look up her name. I've got a...
It wasn't Judy Clark, surely.
Yeah, Judy Clark, yes.
It was Judy Clark?
Yeah, she was.
No, that's just awful, because, of course, she threw Zocher under the bus, you know. I mean, that whole thing in Boston.
She threw Loeffner under the bus, too.
Yeah, see, I think that's her role here. And once they get a prisoner into a psychiatric facility, they can change his behavior, his state of mind, his... Everything about him is subject to variation by means of drugs and other forms of therapy and manipulation.
Yeah, absolutely. And what a better way to, you know, set someone up and then, you know, prevent them from ever, you know, telling the truth. So I followed his court case, and not only did I follow it in the news, but I followed it in the actual court system. Like, I was able to get my hands on every single filing that there was. And so anyway, you know, that's just another reason why I believe that Loeffner was a patsy and he wasn't an actor, is because, you know, like, you can actually trace someone in the court system that is, you know, their motions are being filed and you can follow their footsteps. And so, at this point in time, yeah, I mean, Loeffner is still sitting in Springfield, Missouri, being forcibly medicated. And, you know, his lawyer did file, she had filed in the court system, you know, that Loeffner did not want to be forcibly medicated. She did, according to the documentation, you know, as far as filing it, she did file for him not to be forcibly medicated. However, when you read the documents, and, you know, I will put these all up online for viewers to, you know, be able to read on their own within the next month. And, but, she didn't work that hard at, you know, exposing the truth about this case. And so, you know, there was a law, it was called Washington versus Harper, and that was brought into this case. And what that did was the Loeffner case actually set a precedent that now you can be forcibly medicated if you're a prisoner.
Well, that's very, very bad.
Yeah, that's torture.
It's a tyrannical measure that you would expect from a Stalinist regime, not from a presumptive constitutional republic like the United States of America.
Exactly. And I'm pulling up right now, but also on the governmentreg.com, I have a contributing writer. His name is Arthur Clemens, and he also had written an article about this precedent, and it's called the Loeffner precedent and the Loeffner precedent and the specter of the Stalin-style purge, and it talks about what this particular case, this Loeffner case, and the fact that they're forcibly medicating him using this Washington versus Harper is an act of torture, and now it is legal. And so it can be used now to forcibly medicate anybody that is in the prison system.
Stephanie, that's terribly distressing. I mean, really, talk about a giant step backwards in terms of civil rights and due process. I mean, this is a sign of a fascist regime for certain. I mean, It nauseates me just thinking about this.
Yeah, and also, too, I mean, you know, like, I've always been really interested, Jim, in the medical agenda that is rolling out behind the scenes of all these false flags. And even in the Aurora shooting, you know, most people don't know this, but a judge allowed James Holmes to be given truth serum.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, and so...
Sodium pentothal?
And that is verifiable. And so that is also an act of torture.
That's very, very strange. It seems like a blatant violation of your right to not incriminate yourself, of your Fifth Amendment right. I mean, that how could that be warranted? Stephanie, I'm reaching the point where every one of our rights under the bill are being violated. First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of inquiry. You got James Tracy fired when he's doing brilliant investigative work, exposing a complete scam on the American people.
Yeah.
The New York Times and the Washington Post publishing propaganda and disinformation. And of course, all of these are directed to undermine the Second Amendment, our right to keep and bear arms. The Fourth Amendment against unreasonable search and seizure, Boston was a major contribution in that direction. The Fifth Amendment here, this is a bit outrageous. I mean, the Founding Fathers made these four of the first five amendments for good reason.
Exactly. And I'm glad that you see it, because that's what I see as well, as I see a destruction of just trampling, you know, over the entire Constitution. And while they're doing it, they're also conditioning the American public to accept it. And, you know, just like in the article that I just published just a few days back, it was the five-year anniversary of the Tucson shooting. And, you know, one of the things that I wrote about was how they're conditioning people, you know, through to change the gun laws and, you know, to be accepting of, you know, the, you know, just destroying our Constitution, you know, as long as there's a victim involved and, you know, people are just being mind controlled left and right to accept those types of situations and not question anything. Like, we should always just feel sorry for someone. Go ahead and trample all over my rights, you know, because I feel sorry for that victim. And that's what they're doing.
Yeah, in retrospect, I think I committed a colossal blunder, though I don't know under the circumstances I had a choice. When I supported Barack Obama, of course, he was running against John McCain. How could anyone in the world vote for John McCain? I actually published an article at the time, Stephanie, John McCain, mentally, physically, and morally unfit, which I documented copiously. I mean, the idea, you know, that he would even be the nominee of a major party for the presidency is,
yeah,
is dumbfounding. But, you know, I thought at the time that because of his background with the law at Harvard and teaching constitutional law at Chicago, that Barack Obama actually was the right candidate to place our country back on a firm constitutional footing. But it seems to me he's done anything but.
Yeah, I mean, he's just a puppet, Jim. He's just carrying the agenda forward that, you know, he was groomed to do. And, you know, it really is no different. I mean, you go back and you look at all this and you can slowly see the agenda rising, you know, years and years and years ago. And so now here we are. And, you know, I also want to point out, too, that, you know, there's been over 180 approximately mass shootings since Obama took office. You know, how many executive orders has he written? I mean, just tons of them. And, you know, people just seem to, you know, be okay with it. And they express their anger maybe on Facebook, but I don't see people marching in the streets that our entire, you know, land of the free is being destroyed.
And, you know, Steph, I mean, what we're told, there's this epidemic of shootings. The only epidemic seems to be of the stage shootings, because, I mean, I have right here a study about how gun violence has been declining in the United States since the 1990s, that in particular deaths by firearm per 100,000 people have declined from 7.0 in 1993 to 3.4 in 2014. That's by more than 50% over that 20-year period. And where the drop in non-fatal injuries from firearms has dropped even more dramatically, from 725.3 per 100,000 in 1993 to 174.8 in 2014. So where's this epidemic of gun violence?
Yeah, it definitely is decreasing. And also, Jack Mullen, another contributing writer, he's written many, you know, articles on the same thing about how gun violence is actually decreasing, and has, you know, the statistical data that you also just said. And so, I mean, the gun violence is being, you know, it's going up. If it's going up, it's because it's being staged. It's the focus needs to be on the gun violence, but in actuality, the gun violence, you know, the real gun violence and crime is decreasing. So, you know, like, obviously they're using these events like Sandy Hook. I mean, look what happened after Sandy Hook. I mean, they had all kinds of gun bans going on, and that was their main focus after that. And, you know, I also wrote an article. I wrote a couple articles after the Sandy Hook shooting, and one was called Who's on First, the Bait and Switch at Sandy Hook. And, you know, I wrote actually a lot of the stuff too that was in your book you had also picked up on. And, but I'd also wrote another one called A Bushwhack Sheriff at Newtown. And I had discovered that the entire state of Connecticut, the citizens voted their sheriffs out. They voted them out.
I know that's bizarre. I think it's the only state in the union without any sheriffs. And of course, the sheriffs have a strong commitment to the Constitution. So I believe it was a sign of, you know, increased corruption in Connecticut that they should abolish their sheriffs.
Yeah, and they did it they didn't just, you know, do it and make an executive order or whatever out of it. They actually, the citizens voted the sheriff's offices out. And I was just astounded.
It makes me wonder whether that could have been a manipulated vote. You know, the electronic voting machines are used all over the country. We had a scandal here that the citizens of Wisconsin have not understood, where our governor, Scott Walker, actually was reelected because of manipulations in the voting machines. It's as though you just took all the votes that were being cast for Mary Burke and counted them for Scott Walker and vice versa, because the percentages came out right just for the wrong candidate. Yeah. I followed that very carefully, and I got a statistician who's brilliant, who's actually published on the theft of elections using electronic voting machines, and he turned up proof after proof that that's exactly what had happened. For example, in Milwaukee County, Stephanie, which is a bastion of Democratic support. And by the way, we had an historic turnout, which traditionally favors Democrats. He discovered that the larger the number of votes that were cast in Milwaukee County, the greater the percentage of the vote that went to the Republican candidate, Scott Walker. And he even went back and discovered that the recall election had similarly been manipulated using these voting machines. And just ask yourself now about Connecticut voting out sheriffs. Why in the world would any citizen want to reduce the number of levels of law enforcement in their state?
Well, I mean, that's the big question. And that's why I wrote that article, you know, called A Bushwhack Sheriff in Newtown. And I opened it up by saying, you know, the shh of Newtown, because, you know, my question is where was the sheriff and why wasn't he investigating? All we saw was this Lieutenant Vance. And, right. You know, like people, the sheriff works for the people. I would assume that the people would want to know what the sheriff had to say. And, but he was nowhere to be found. And it was because that they had voted him out. And I thought the same thing, like, you know, it was probably corruption, you know, in these voting machines, or, you know, maybe they just simply mind controlled all the people through the television, you know, to go vote their sheriff out. Either way, you know. And so that brings me to a question to you, Jim, and what can be done when corruption and lawlessness encompasses an entire state?
Well, it's bizarre, Stephanie. It's absolutely bizarre. And I'm very glad that this book may be making a contribution to revealing the dimensions of the scandal, because most Americans think, oh, this would involve so many people, it can't be true. But when you look at the evidence, there's simply no way around it. The school was closed by 2008. There were no children there, and therefore no one for Adam Lanza to have shot. It goes on and on and on. 50 photographs of them furnishing the Lanza home, 50 photographs of them refurbishing the school. I mean, the proof is monumental.
Yeah, after reading your book, Jim, I can honestly say that you have just a truckload of proof. And so, you know, I've been asking everybody, you know, do they know that nobody died at Sandy Hook? And so that is the question. And, you know, after reading your book, and I really, you know, I mean, I would like to talk to you personally about, you know, a few things in this book here, but, you know, there was so much material and pictures
yes.
I hadn't seen. And,
yes.
And I'm the type of person that, like, if you give me something like this to read, you know, I'm going to look through it with an open eye. I'm not going to just take your word for it. Like, I looked at it and
yes.
I examined it, and, you know, I came to a lot of the same conclusions that you did. That,
well, we are not infallible, and we have found some misinterpretations. For example, that the classic photograph exhibit 26 in chapter 8, where we have the SWAT team present, the windows of classroom 10 are undamaged. Crime scene tape is up for a crime that is yet to be committed.
Right.
Alan Powell, who resides in Australia, believed that that was a morning of the 14th photograph, but we're now convinced it was in fact the evening of the 13th. But what is crucial about it is the fact the windows of classroom 10 are undamaged, which means it's before the event, the purported shooting, has taken place.
Yeah, I saw that in there. And we can go on to the next slide. Further in the slides, I have similar photos of that. Yeah, now this was, you know, following the shooting, there, of course, Anderson Cooper and mainstream media, and, you know, they all had victims and their families and friends a lot after went on mainstream to tell what I believe were ridiculous stories, because, you know, they just were, I mean, clearly their stories didn't add up. But one of the victims, who her name was Mary Reed, and she's on the picture on the right there. She's the mother wearing the black dress. And anyway, she was allegedly shot at the scene that day. So she was one of the 13 that actually survived. And she went on to Anderson Cooper's show, and her daughter, Emma, had claimed to the American public that she called 911 and was helping her mom, who had been shot, and she was, you know, like, putting pressure on the gunshot wounds. And she tells Anderson Cooper, you know, all these details about how, you know, she tried to keep her mother alive. And so anyway, I decided that I would try to find the 911 call that this Emma made. And so I did find her 911 call. And it turns out that she was hiding in the back of the Walgreens store, which was next to the Safeway store, which was where the shooting occurred. And she told 911, you know, that she was hiding in the back, and, you know, she hopes that they get there soon. And so, you know, right there, I mean, she had made this 911 call, claimed all this stuff to Anderson Cooper. And my question to her is, Emma, why didn't you mention your mom when you were on the call with the 911? I mean, a daughter would say, hey, my mom's been shot. Get an ambulance here now. My mom, my mom, my mom. But she didn't even mention her mom.
Wow. That's good. That's very good, Stanley. What about the gunman's best friend? What does he say? Why Lochner crap?
Now, yeah, the gunman's best friend was actually quite hilarious to watch, because he did a horrible, horrible job of acting. And, you know, he tried to fake cry, and he went on about how Lochner needed to get some help. And if he would have just got some help, you know, this could have all.
Stephanie, you know, once we find faked elements of an event like this, it's reasonable to conclude the whole event was staged.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do believe that this, the Lochner event was a drill. And I believe that, you know, there were actors and that there was a lot of staging going on in the media. However, I also believe that they used a patsy to change a law, and that in the process of that, at least one person that I can, you know, absolutely say for sure is dead, and that would be Judge John Roll.
Yes.
So was he assassinated at the crime scene that day? I cannot tell you 100% yes or 100% no, because there is there was some evidence that was found that there was somebody that had been shot at another Safeway store across town that day.
Really?
That would have been closer to Judge John Roll's home. And of course they couldn't get the story straight whether Judge John Roll had actually gone there. There were three stories that had emerged. One was that he came from Mass and was going over to buy some floor cleaner. And there was another story that he stopped by to see Gabrielle Giffords and talk to her about some immigration problems, even though a judge is not allowed to do that. And also, there was another story that surfaced that, you know, he had showed up there and he was actually visiting his son that worked there. But I couldn't find any evidence of that, nor could I get any answers on that. So do I believe anybody died in this shooting? Like I said before, I have 6 autopsies and I got them directly from the place they do autopsies. And, you know, but...
You picked those up in person when you were in Tucson?
I did. I went there and I filled out the forms and asked them to give them to me.
Is it possible the judge could have been shot at the other Safeway and then they used this as a cover story for his death?
Exactly. It's definitely something that I've thought about. And also, but I want to tell you, though, that when it comes to the autopsy reports, and I will... quickly interject here. I did write a book. It's called Apple Zebra 11, and it's called The Loftner Cover-Up. And, you know, you can get that. You can go online and order that through lulu.com. Or if you donate $5 or more to the government rag, I will give you a PDF for free. So anyway, it has the autopsies in the back. It's got just a huge amount of information that was never talked about on
mainstream. How many pages are stuff? That looks like a substantial book.
It does. It's got a total of about 472 pages.
Wow. Very good. Very good.
Yeah. And
tell us the title again.
It's called Apple Zebra 11, and it's called The Loftner Cover-Up. And in the background is a picture here. It's called Operation Safeway.
Why did you pick the title Apple Zebra 11?
Because it was a drill and it was a special medical ops.
Oh, that was the name for the drill.
The Operation Safeway. And of course we have the, you know, the 11 to the 11th power is how I put it in the book, which is the year. And so, you know, and the A and the Z and the 11 equal 9/11.
By the way, I love your slides. I think they're just wonderful.
Oh, well, let's just keep continuing if you'd like.
Yeah, indeed. Yes, indeed.
So, anyway, why didn't you mention your mom? We already went through that. And then also I had put the video there too. But, and then the next slide, well, yeah, I think that might be a video. But what I had done was I had put her interview with, or that was the 911 call. And so, and then these are the deceased, the alleged deceased people. And among the dead was Judge John Roll, who you see up where he's on the right at the top. And then the thing about Judge John Roll was that he overturned the previous gun confiscation plot, which was called the Brady Bill. And his death was swept under the rug.
And he ruled against the Brady Bill?
He did. He ruled.
Well, that's very, very significant.
Yeah, he was the judge that ruled that it was unconstitutional. And so he had a deep connection to gun, you know, control as far as him as a judge. But, you know, I wrote an entire chapter about Judge John Roll in my book, and I even put a video out on YouTube about Judge John Roll because, I mean, his life, he had a lot that he was facing as a judge, and his death was swept under the rug, and, you know, the media focused on two main victims, and that was the Christina Green, who was the 9/11 girl, and also they focused on this one of the alleged survivors, which was
Gabrielle Giffords, of course.
Yeah, Gabrielle Giffords.
Yeah.
And so, right, and the other victims I found out who survived were mostly staff members, bloggers, former military people, Raytheon workers, social workers, and et cetera. So, you know, the people that were allegedly at that event that day that were shot but survived, you know, most of them have military or military contract experience.
Well, I think the fact that he overrode the Brady bill and thereby was thwarting the gun control agenda, which they want to promote to usher in the new world order, creates an awfully powerful motive for retaliating against him, even setting an example for those who discern a connection.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact, too, that, you know, with the gun confiscation debate and the plot that happened because of this particular event, you know, he could have been standing in the way with that as well, the future agenda. And so, or maybe questioned it. However, Judge John Roll also had a big hand in immigration. And there was also a report that was reported on following his death, you know, that had to do with the Forfeiture Act. And it was labeled right away that it was disinformation. But I decided to go ahead and actually get the file. Like, I got the whole court document and read all the files. And it was actually true as well. Like, he was getting ready to rule again or rule for a case that had to do with the Forfeiture Act. And, you know, the thing was, is that he died before he could actually make the final ruling. And so I believe that if he would have made the ruling, if he would have lived and made the ruling, that he would have ruled against attorney Dennis Burke, who, you know, they had confiscated several thousand dollars from somebody that was pulled over, and he was found not guilty, and they didn't want to give him his money back. And so anyway, he had taken it, you know, higher up in the courts, and Judge John Roll was to have ruled on that. So if he would have ruled that the kid should get his $3,000 back, or maybe it was $6,000 at the time, I can't remember for sure, but, you know, that would have put a dent in the Forfeiture Act to have to give money back.
Well, you know, Steph, there's another positive reason, you know, before he rules. When Charles Harrelson, who you may or may not be aware, was a tallest of the three tramps who were marched through Dealey Plaza. He was a hitman for the mob. He was eventually convicted of killing a federal judge with a rifle, a very rare crime in American history, because the judge was known as John Maximum Wood for giving maximum sentences, and it was a drug dealer who was going to be sentenced and did not want it to be by Woods. So he had Harrelson kill him. This is the father of actor Woody Harrelson, by the way.
Wow.
So this idea of killing a judge, you know, because someone doesn't want them to render a decision or issue a punishment is not at all unprecedented. I think it's very important to hear.
Exactly. I totally agree. And that's interesting information that you just gave to me, by the way. And yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, last night I found myself, you know, doing some more research into Judge John Roll, just because, you know, there was a lot of people online that I call them, you know, they're definitely disinformation. Like, they put out a lot of stuff where, you know, they'll, especially comparisons, well, they'll say this person is that person, but, you know, and a lot of people will just pick it up and run with it. But You know, Judge John Roll was accused of being, you know, somebody that he wasn't, you know, claiming that he was also an actor. But, you know, of course, I, you know, just made all that go away because he really was a judge. And I was able to prove that over and over and over again. And but, yeah, I mean, the dead judge is dead. And what I found most interesting was, Jim, 6 months after his death, Obama and Janet Napolitano and Eric Holder and several others, you know, were there to sign the name of the new courthouse in Yuma, Arizona, after Judge John Roll. And following that signing, there was another shooting that had happened. And there were 6 people that were dead there, involved in that new courthouse, and it was completely swept under the rug. I mean, it was like in a couple of newspapers, but no one ever even heard about it.
This was another shooting after they named a courthouse after Judge Roll?
Yeah.
That's pretty bizarre. Steph, we got to take a break. Is this a good point?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. It's my special guest, Stephanie Sledge. We're talking about the Tucson shooting, unraveling some of its mysteries with an expert on the subject. We'll be right back.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Less than 3% of you people read books. Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host. Continuing my conversation with Stephanie Sledge, who's done a massive amount of work, even published a 400-page book about the Tucson shooting, which I'm looking forward to reading. Steph, I know you have these wonderful slides. I want to give you the opportunity to cover them all, so let's roll.
All right. Okay, well, this next slide right here, one of the things about the Tucson shooting was what happened after the Tucson shooting, and that was that Obama brought the 9/11 flag to Tucson. And I always say it was to mark the territory because that's exactly what happened. And so he brought the 9/11 flag to Tucson, had a giant memorial where everybody, you know, just worshiped that 9/11 flag. And meanwhile, you know, as you know, the case was unfolding and the shooting was unfolding. You know, the sheriff over there in that county, Sheriff Dupnik, he was on TV telling the world Jared Lee Loughner was a mental case instead of investigating the crime scene. So as you can see by the pictures, you know, that was the 9/11 flag and they brought it to Tucson. So they used the little girl who was allegedly born on 9/11 and you know, it took place on January 8th, which is 9 of 2011. So you can pull 9/11 out of that as well. So they did use that to revisit 9/11. America had to revisit. We just never can forget.
Well, what a massive psychological distraction from the details of the crime.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I look at these pictures, I am disgraced because I know the truth about, you know, these false flags and 9/11 and such. But when other people that don't know look at these, all they see are victims, which is what is part of the agenda in this, is to bring about the victims and to bring a psychological operation onto the individual's mind.
Good, good. Go for it.
So, anyway, on the next slide, there it is again. We have police officers holding and worshiping the flag. And then, you know, we must never forget.
I got to tell you, this was a deliberate psyop so people wouldn't think about what had actually happened in Tucson. I have no doubt about it, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it really was. It turned into a... you know, it was a place for Obama to perform on a stage. And, you know, all the other minions came as well, like John McCain and Pelosi and, you know, Napolitano and several other people.
You can't believe the horror stories I've heard about Janet Napolitano.
Oh, well, I've got plenty of them in my book that are related to Judge John Roll. So you'll be looking forward to even reading them.
Good, good.
So, and then you can turn to the next slide. Okay, and then, this goes along with Sheriff Dupnik, like he was on TV. And, of course, we have the University Medical Center sign in the background. So we already know right away that the first speech that rolled out in the mainstream media was Sheriff Dupnik on his rant about how unbalanced people and how they respond to the vitriol that comes out of the mouths of certain individuals about tearing down the government.
I think you can see, yeah. So they're tying it into conspiracy theorists too, aren't they?
Yeah, and they also tie it into bigotry, and he labels Arizona is the mecca for prejudice. And then, of course, like I say, there's the University Medical Center in the background symbol. And so there we have the tie-in as well. There was a lot of medical agenda that happened in this case, Jim. I mean, everything from suspended animation to, mental health. So.
Very, very good. Yeah. I think we're just seeing this package evolving of trying to fault, individuals who, as Lone Dot, goes all the way back to Lee Oswald, Sirhan, neither of whom had anything to do with the actual shooting of Jack or Bobby.
Yeah.
And bringing in the conspiracy theorists and the mental health criteria and gun control. I mean, shooting a judge who'd overrid the Brady Bill, that's quite a stunning aspect of all of this.
Yeah, and he just happened to be at the right place at the wrong time. So, and then we can move forward from here. Now, I put this one in because this is a questionable picture from the crime scene that was released to the AP press. And, this was a crime scene photo that they claimed. And there's a lot of things that aren't adding up. For instance, there's no broken glass where the shopping carts are. That is a full glass. Nope, it hadn't even been shot. And so that was where the actual shooting had taken place, and that there were reports that people on the inside, claimed that they were getting their shopping carts and bullets came through the window. And so anyway, as you can see, this picture has no broken glass. These are supposed to be dead people laying at the scene here. We've got, looks like a sheriff doing pictures and wearing gloves, but not any official forensics type of investigation going on.
Is that supposed to be the judge lying there?
I don't know. I could never get an answer to that. But
if you looked at the different victims, he's the only one that could be, isn't it?
Well, and he is wearing a suit. And,
the hand, Stephanie, looks completely wrong. That looks like a dummy. That doesn't look like a real hand.
Yeah, it doesn't look like a real victim to me as well, because of the fact that, all the forensics are wrong. The only thing they got is gloves on. I mean, the camera that he's taking pictures with is not even a forensic camera. And then, we have this sheriff over here on the right. And I mean, mostly when people do forensics, there's a way that they have to follow policies and procedures.
Yes, protocols.
About it.
Yeah.
Right. And so anyway, as you can see, this crime scene definitely looks staged. And the other thing that I found interesting about this crime scene photo is if you look in the background, you can see what appears to look like possibly a bridge. And also in the way back is the mountains. But when you actually go to the Safeway store out in Tucson and you turn around from that spot and look out, you do not see that mountain there.
Great. That's great, Steph. That's terrific.
So, anyway, that's a crime scene photo that didn't add up. We can go on.
Yeah, purported crime scene.
Yeah, absolutely. And then here are more crime scene photos that don't add up. I mean, they do look staged to me, especially since because I took what the witnesses said in their interviews, and I, tried to match them to the crime scene, and, they just don't add up. I mean, the crime scene photos appear to have been staged, obviously, from the beginning. And, I did ask myself, was this a drill? Were there actors? What's happening here? And you can clearly see that, there's no blood in any of that you can visibly see. They're working on what appears to be a victim there, but there's no blood. However, the woman standing up has blood, but only on her knees. And so, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And, we got one sheriff down in the lower right-hand corner who's smiling. Seems to be, hey, everything's okay over here,
The black sheriff.
Yeah. And so, anyway, as you can see, it appears that the crime scene to me was staged.
I think you're doing a very, very good job with this, Stephanie.
Thank you. And then on the next one. Now, one of the things that I found interesting about the Loughner case was, it brought me back to when I was reading in your book about the house that he lived in.
Yeah.
His own home, you know, how it appeared to be staged. And,
right.
And this came from his home. These are photos that were released from AP Press allegedly saying that this was the back of Loughner's house. And of course they also tied in words like satanic and rituals. And, you know, I mean,
that's not even a real wall. Of course, that's just some kind of tent or material hanging down. I mean, that's not a permanent structure there.
No. And also, you know, the picture too, that shows someone that's supposedly possibly shooting an American flag was said to also be one of Loughner's videos. He put a series of videos.
Well, he's supposed to be shooting at an American flag.
Yeah. And
that's
so
stupid as anything I've ever heard. It's a piece of cloth, for God's sake. I mean, why would you shoot at a flag? That's just the dumbest phony piece of nonsense. God.
Well, as you can see with all three of these photos tied together, it's a way to make him look crazy. And so anyway, while I was out in Tucson, I actually jumped the fence and went to the back of the house and discovered that it didn't look like that at all. And so anyway, it was all staged from the beginning. And I also did find a police report when I was digging through police reports trying to find the identity of Loughner. That there was a reporter that was arrested following the shooting because she had done the same thing. She had climbed over the wall and tried to get, you know, to find out if these photos were real, but they had caught her and arrested her. And so I found that quite interesting.
Well, look at the lower right with his hood and all that. You couldn't possibly identify who that's supposed to be. I mean, that's obviously fake.
Yeah, and these were supposedly in videos that he put up on YouTube because there were several videos, which I address in my book, and that he allegedly published on YouTube, of course, you know, that makes him look crazy. So.
Go.
And then on the next slide. And then we have here, these are parents of Christina Taylor Greene. And this was when Obama had blew through town in Tucson and had the 9/11 memorial. And as you can see,
how can you be happy like that when your daughter's been killed?
Yeah, I mean, this photo was stunning.
This is Robbie Parker at Sandy Hook.
It is, and I thought about that as well. And so they're having a great time as they're supposed to be a huge memorial for their dead daughter. And as you can see by the little boy that's there, which is Christina Taylor Greene's, I believe, older brother who has autism. He doesn't look very happy, but, you know, definitely the mother, Roxana Greene, and the father, John Greene, they definitely.
And look at Michelle Obama, for God's sake.
Yeah.
She's having a grand time.
Yeah. They were very happy there clapping. And
bizarre. When you see gross discrepancies from ordinary human emotions in a certain type of situation, you've got to suspect something is terribly, terribly wrong.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, if my daughter had died, you know, like I couldn't even find an ounce of smiling.
Oh, you'd be catatonic for a month.
Yeah. Or longer.
I agree.
And, you know, one of the things about this particular day was that I have several photos. This is just the one that I posted. And during the entire time that Obama was at the McHale Stadium and it was packed full of people, you know, every time they showed a shot of these parents, they were not grieving.
Yeah. We don't have any shots of them grieving.
Yeah, no shots of them grieving, no.
I think it's fair to infer, therefore, that they did not go through a period of grief.
I don't believe so. And, you know, I mean, You know, I initially thought, and you can turn the page if you'd like, because I know we're going to get into this soon, but initially I had wondered if the 9/11 girl was real or if she was an actress, because there were comparisons put out online saying that she was an actor from the Greenbergs. And so anyway, one of the things that I did purposely undercover while I was in Tucson was I actually infiltrated the school that she went to so that I could try to get evidence of whether this girl was real or not. And so, anyway, up in the corner there is a picture of the mom next to Gabrielle Giffords, next to her husband slash who I believe is her handler, Mark Kelly. And then on the bottom.
The bald guy.
Right. And he's the one that's on TV all the time with her now, you know, promoting gun confiscation. And they created a lobby group. And, you know, they're just traveling all over the place for gun control. And at the bottom left picture is the mother. And then next to her is his name is Dallas Green. And that's Christina Taylor Green's alleged grandfather. And he was the, you know, he spent his whole life in professional sports. And he managed the Philadelphia Phillies. You know, he did quite a bit in baseball. And so the mother was married to John Green, whose father was Dallas Green, who's a famous baseball player. And as you can see, these are all different pictures that I have obtained during my investigation.
During your infiltration of the school, did you get any reason to believe she was real and had been a student there?
I did. And if you turn the page, we'll go into more. But yeah, what I did was, and I had gone to the school, and I was actually with another researcher that lived in Tucson that had the same questions. And so basically what happened was, is that I had gone to the school, and I had asked them if I could go into their library, and they gave me permission to go into the library. And from there, I had pulled, several years, well, for Christina Taylor Green, it would have been 3 years because she was in third grade when she died, but I had pulled all of the books, the class books, to see if I could find verification that she was, you know, a student there. And I did. Like, she was in kindergarten, first, second, third grade, and I found her picture. It had her name next to the other students, and I didn't have any reason to believe that those books were staged, because clearly they had been looked at over and over again. I mean, they were
worn, not fresh.
Yeah. Right. And so, and there was also a few other marks in them. Like, you know, I found one page, somebody had put a star next to another student, which probably just meant that they were there and wanted to remember it. So anyway, those books were definitely real books. But one of the most interesting thing about this whole thing at the school, Jim, was while I was in the library, the man that you see right there with Gabrielle Giffords, her husband, Mark Kelly, his picture was in the library as an astronaut. And it just blew my mind. I'm like, why are you here in the library at this little girl's school? And so he had a signed picture of himself in a display case in her school.
That is kind of odd.
It is very odd.
And you mentioned astronaut. Is he supposed to be an astronaut?
Yeah, he just retired from being an astronaut, I believe, a year to a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago. His twin brother is Scott Kelly, who is right now, as we speak, I believe he's up in the International Space Station. And I will send you a really good article about the plot and that involves the astronauts and NASA and the Navy and how they're involved in this case. And so anyway, his face showed up, a signed photograph in the school of the dead girl.
Do you ever have any reason to think that Gabrielle had not suffered the wound she has appeared to have suffered?
I have a couple of different things that I think about Giffords. And one thing that I think about Giffords is, no, she did not suffer a gunshot bullet wound to the head, simply because, you know, one doctor at the crime scene there that day, he couldn't even tell you whether she was shot from front to back, back to front. And then also the surgeon himself, you know, he couldn't get his story straight either about whether she was shot from the front to the back, back to the front. And I've talked to multiple people, like over the course of the last 5 years, I've ran into a lot of people that are in the medical industry. And, you know, I tend to go out of my way to ask people about gunshot wounds. And so anyway, I know that it is said that Gabrielle Giffords was shot directly in the head and she survived by, you know, them using suspended animation and performing emergency surgery on her. But it doesn't appear to me that, you know, her wound, I mean, from the very get-go, there wasn't even a, you know, any type of evidence that she was shot in the head. And I also have another take to Gabrielle Giffords, that she isn't really the real Gabrielle Giffords that was, you know, she possibly could be an actress herself. And she has many differences to the original Gabrielle Giffords that I have.
Really? So this could be an imposter, an impersonator.
I mean, you could definitely, you know, think about those things and wonder.
This is all in your book?
I do. I have it all in my book.
Fantastic. I can't wait to read it, Stephanie.
Well, thank you. And so anyway, Gabrielle Giffords is always, you know, somebody in the forefront of this entire thing, including Sandy Hook. You know, they're friends over there, and they came to help get the guns, you know, as soon as Sandy Hook took place. And she was, you know, one of the first people there in her speeches with her husband, Mark Kelly. And, you know, they were the biggest advocates to take the guns out of the hands of, you know, the state. And they still are today. So, anyway,
Arizona has always been a real strong gun rights state, you know. I mean, a Western state. I mean, a lot of people believe in the Second Amendment out there in Arizona.
Yeah, I agree. Out in Arizona, they are for guns. I mean, they don't want to see guns banned at all. And so, you know, Gabrielle Giffords and Mark Kelly, they travel around to where these shootings take place, where, you know, it doesn't seem like the states really have, you know, a whole lot of worries about their guns. So anyway, they go wherever the vulnerability is at. And so her commitment to democracy, it came with a heavy price, and they thanked her for that. They thanked her for her sacrifice, and that picture right there was actually at, you know, one of the at one of the memorials following the shooting, and that was for Gabrielle Giffords. So
okay.
So, and we can move on here, and and Gabrielle Giffords has had a lot, you know, like she's been at the forefront of this whole event. They suspended animation technology was approved for battlefield medical agenda, and also DARPA and also NASA. And Giffords was also presented with a ship called the USS Giffords. I don't know if you knew that or not, Jim, but the Navy presented her with the new USS Gabrielle Giffords, which is currently being built as we are talking. And it's the new LCS-10 ship. And so they named a ship after her, and they presented it. It's kind of funny. When they presented the ship to her, they presented it when they took off the veil. It was presented upside down, and they had to turn it right side up. So I always make a joke that, you know, it was presented upside down and cracked in half because the stage was cracked in half that they were on. And so that's a sinking ship. And also with Gabrielle Giffords, you know, she had her new comic books of heroism was created called Female Force. And they also created a new gun lobby group called Americas for Responsible Solutions. And so as you can see, you know, this one victim of this shooting has a lot of people gaining, you know, technology and money and medical agenda and, of course, collecting guns as well. So
those two faces don't look to me to be of the same person on the female force. Decidedly different than the short hair. I don't mean just the difference in the hair. They don't look the same.
Right. And when we move forward, I have other pictures of Gabrielle Giffords as well. And then here's in the school where I show that there was the actual picture of Mark Kelly in the school. And so I found that questionable. And then also following this, the school itself was chosen for the NASA downlink. And they said it didn't have anything to do with Christina Taylor Greene, but I found it quite strange that his picture was in there and how NASA is deeply tied to this case, you know, especially with Mark Kelly being Gabrielle Giffords' husband.
Very, very interesting. This is an aspect of which I have heretofore been completely unaware. Fascinating.
Well, yeah, that's quite a bit of information that never got out. And so, and then as you see here, these are different pictures of Gabrielle, like in the top center one with the red scarf around her sitting next to Mark Kelly. This is the Gabrielle Giffords following the shooting. And then the next picture over on the top right.
Yeah, it doesn't look to me like the same person at all.
And that's the original Gabrielle Giffords, you know, with Mark Kelly. And then at the bottom left is a picture that I found, three Hadassah members that she was involved in. This is the Gabrielle Giffords before the shooting.
Isn't that a Jewish organization?
It is. And Gabrielle Giffords was Jewish, and she had very deep ties to a lot of Jewish agenda.
What's the Hadassah organization? I'm very faint in my mind about its role.
Well, I wrote about Hadassah in my book, and I would have to update myself a little bit on that before I can answer the question. But the center picture as well, that one was a picture of her taken at a previous Congresswoman on the Corner event where she, you know, before she was allegedly shot. And then, of course, the bottom right picture is a picture of Mark Kelly and his crew.
You sure got into some fascinating aspects of this, Stephanie.
Well, it just connecting the dots, it just blew me away how much was all involved in this entire case and who knew who and who was involved. And so, but yeah, I agree that there is, the Gabrielle Giffords before the shooting looks a lot different than the Gabrielle Giffords after the shooting. And a lot of people will argue with me and they'll say, well, that's because she had surgery. Well, but, you know, there's other aspects that surgery didn't touch, you know, and that was, you know, her actual facial structure.
Chance observes that the Hadassah is the Women's Zionist Organization of America.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Wow. And of course, the Zionists put the interests of Israel ahead of the interests of any other state, including the United States. So that's troubled, you know.
The other thing, too, Jim, is I also got my hands on, and I wrote this in my book, too. I published a copy of it, and that is that prior to Gabrielle Giffords getting shot, she did write a letter to Israel and pledge her allegiance to them. And so is the real Gabrielle Giffords really the one that is here now promoting gun control? I mean, or, you know, is Gabrielle Giffords, you know, over and...
I'm beginning to wonder how much of the gun control agenda is Zionist inspired. You know, Cynthia McKinney has revealed that when new members of Congress come to Washington, they're asked to sign a pledge to put the interests of Israel ahead of those of the United States. And almost everyone signs, and those who don't find themselves confronted by a well-financed alternative candidate or perhaps redistricted out of their seats. So, you know, this is a very powerful movement.
This is a very powerful movement. I agree. I mean, it's more than powerful. It's at the forefront. And so, yeah, those are definite things that, you know, need to be talked about and questioned more.
Good. This is a great set of photographs.
Yeah, we can move forward. Okay, now, also, I do believe that we do have actors in this case, and here's one of them right here. His name was Joe Zamudio, and he was one of the actors that day that allegedly helped tackle Loeffner and said he was carrying a gun, but he didn't need to use it, and he also claimed to the American public that he worked with his mother at her gallery. That was what he did. But as the story unfolded, he was seen in several sets of different clothing that day and being interviewed. And also a picture had surfaced. And there was somebody also in Tucson that did verify to me that Joe Zamudio really was an EMT. And so I have the photograph there with the arrow pointing down at him. That is Joe Zamudio. And he is in an EMT outfit, allegedly transporting Giffords. But he was also a witness on mainstream media claiming that he had tackled the gunman. He was a hero. I believe Joe Zamudio is definitely one of the actors.
Sounds like he was there too early. If he's early enough to tackle the gunman, then why would he be showing up as an EMT?
Right.
And Dennis has observed that on these, transporting them off, that there's no blood on the gurneys.
Yeah, and especially because the only ones that you really see are just Gabrielle Giffords. Like, if anybody can provide me with, you know, any other transporting picture like this, you know, I would love to see it that has a different victim on it because, you know, I couldn't find anybody but Gabrielle Gifford pictures. And, just the fact, too, that, you know, that picture was obviously taken at a different time, but that is Joe Zamudio, and he also claimed that, you know, I mean, he showed up on one TV, he's wearing, you know, a black hoodie, he showed up on another TV, he's wearing a different shirt, you know, and his story never adds up, and it turns out that after I investigated, you know, the stories pretty hard, I realized that he didn't tackle Loeffner. You know, none of the stories of these alleged people that survived that said that they were witnesses or that they tackled Loeffner, you know, and took away his gun. You listen to 911 calls and the cops are saying, where is the gun? They can't find it. It's in the grass somewhere maybe. And I mean, so, you know, the witnesses did lie about what happened. And, you know, there were, if we were to go off of all the reports, there would have been five people that tackled Loeffner. And
well, do we have a report on the caliber of the weapon he's alleged to have used?
He used a 9mm Glock, and it had an extended magazine. Allegedly, he had brought an extended magazine and an extra one. And that was one of the focuses of the gun debate afterwards, is that we need to ban we don't need magazines. And so, he had a 9mm is what he brought with an extended magazine.
Okay.
So we can move forward from here. And this was another actor. His name was Dr. Stephen Rail. And Dr. Stephen Rail claimed that he had 18 years of medical emergency experience and that he was at the crime scene that day of the shooting and that he was actually shot at as well. And he claimed that he held Gabrielle Giffords upright, was holding her head together until the ambulance got there. And he went on mainstream media and, you know, but after evaluating all of his interviews, he absolutely had no knowledge whatsoever of working in the medical field. And, you know, he also described Loeffner as wearing sweatpants and had short hair. But, you know, according to the arrest records, he had a black hoodie and a pair of jeans on. And so this man right here also put up a Facebook page and he claimed that there were 18 injured and 8 dead. And I found that strange for somebody who claims that they're a medical doctor. Yes. There was only
a medical doctor who can't count.
Yeah, and he put it on Facebook. He
now, that is more than you could do with the fingers of your one and two hands, but there it is.
So that's Dr. Stephen Rail. And when I investigated him, you know, I found that there is a Dr. Rail that actually is licensed with a he does have a medical degree, but I don't believe that that actual Dr. Stephen Rail is this
the same one.
Right. Yeah. It's a different person. So anyway, he was an actor as well. And he put up a lot of videos that in the mainstream media that are, to me, were just, you know, I couldn't help but laugh because he was so uneducated in his alleged medical knowledge.
Yes.
So.
Excellent. Next slide.
And so there's Loeffner in the drawings. And so anyway.
That's how different he looks from that initial photograph we were given. I'm struck by that.
Yeah, me too, considering he's supposed to be bald. And he looks much older in this photograph. You know, I mean, if I was to guess off of just a courtroom drawing, I would say that's, you know, like a 35 to 40 year old man.
Yes.
Not a 22 year old.
Yes. Good.
And I believe, yeah, there we go. And then also too, this is something that, you know, most of America does not know about Jerry Loeffner. And that is that Loeffner had reported his own identity stolen prior to this shooting. And I found the police reporter, I found several police reports where Jerry Loeffner had gotten into some trouble when he was a teenager, and when he was, you know, around 17, 18. And, you know, he just for minor things like, you know, paraphernalia for pot. And, you know, like he got drunk one time with a friend and they defaced a sign. And so he had been arrested a few times for, you know, just some minor things. So there was, you know, some history of Jerry Loeffner. But one of the things that I found most interesting is the fact that I found a report which Loeffner himself had reported his identity stolen. And he had claimed to the Foothills Police Department that he discovered a MySpace page. And that MySpace, you know, was depicting it as being him. And so he filed a report with the Foothills Police Department claiming that his identity had been stolen and that he had looked it up on Piqio and found the page and had an old picture of him when he had longer hair. And he had told the police that he thought his friend Alex had done it. And one of the things that I thought was most strange is that As soon as the shooting happened, the very first thing that was reported on mainstream media was they were showing his MySpace page. And it was this page that Loeffner himself had reported stolen. And so anyway, there's a whole trail down that road right there.
Yeah,
and
well, clearly he's being framed. He's being set up for showing the weapon. Stephanie, this is as blatant as it gets.
Yeah.
It's like the backyard photograph of Lee Oswald with the man liquor Carcano and the revolver with which he's alleged to have shot Officer Tippett, which was faked by pasting his face on somebody else's body. I mean, this is the equivalent for Loeffner.
Exactly. And the fact, too, that, you know, he reported it stolen. And his own mother, who, you know, there was never any live videos or any interviews or anything from any of Loeffner's parents. And so I did investigate them as deeply as I could. I couldn't get a hold of them when I went out to Loeffner's house and knocked on their door. But, you know, it appeared that nobody at the time was living there, at least while I was.
Well, how could the mother have not mentioned this when all this was swirling around? I mean, it would be essential information to report.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, If this happened to one of my children or my niece or nephew or whoever, I would be screaming at the rooftop, you know, wait a minute, you're showing a page that my son reported his identity stolen. So just to let, you know, the American public know, Jerilee Loughner filed a police report and that MySpace had been stolen. So, and they've
created. Yeah, because, I mean, this is the, you know, if nobody can find the gun, I mean, this is supposed to be the evidence that connects him to the gun. This page that appears to be a total fabrication.
Exactly. It is. It is an exact fabrication, and it has the weapon that he allegedly used. And of course, United States history is a book when he put up a bunch of videos, you know, allegedly before the shooting that mocks the government and, you know, and stuff like that.
Right, right. They're setting up the themes they're going to cite later. So they're setting it up so that they, when they write about it, the elements they want to write to create the impression in the public are already embedded in these background issues that they fake.
Well, and not only that, but there's more setting him up when it comes to social sites because, you know, he was also only, Gabrielle Giffords only had two friends, and that was Ike Skelton from Missouri, and also Jerilee Loughner. So, I mean.
Loughner was supposed to be a friend of Gabrielle?
Yeah.
You're kidding me.
On her YouTube page.
You're kidding me.
No, and I got that in my book too, Jim.
Stephanie, that's insane. That's absolutely insane.
Yeah, and there's a really, really good article that if America wants to read, it's called, that I wrote, and you can find it on my bio on thegovernmentrag.com, and it's called How NASA and the Navy Aided in Trading American Guns for Technology and Littoral Warships. And in there, I cover the setup with his social site there. And Representative Ike Skelton was the only one. And, you know, how convenient, Jim. Not only is he the only one that is friends with Gabby along with Jerilee Loughner, but he also was there when they presented her the USS Gabrielle Giffords ship. So, yeah. Anyway, it's quite funny if you ask me. They just
I think you've blown this case apart, my opinion.
Well, they just totally forgot to, you know, erase their mistakes. And they didn't think anybody would be, you know, smart enough to find them. And so, anyway, here I am.
Fascinating. Wonderful. I love it.
Thank you. So we can turn the page. All right. The other evidence that I have is quite interesting. And I told you that, well, first of all, I want to tell you that the mainstream media and the AP press, like they all reported that Jerilee Loughner never left home. Like he always lived with his parents after high school and that, you know, he was just a lonely kid and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it turns out that I found a police report, I had done a background check and it turns out that Jerilee Loughner had listed, you know, that he was listed at a different address and that he had also listed a phone number that was attached to his name. And anyway, when I ran that phone number came back under D. Green. And, you know, so I questioned, was D. Green Dallas Green? You know, Dallas Green was the 9/11 girl's grandfather who is the famous.
It's getting pretty tight here, isn't it? We're getting a pretty narrow circle of involved players.
Yeah, I mean, see, they just forgot to delete all their mistakes. But I will tell you, though, that while I was in Tucson, I did speak to an individual that did tell me. And she did not want to be named. She wanted this to be anonymous, but I will tell you that she did tell me that she did live across the hall from Jerilee Loughner, who was living with who she believed was his uncle. And she told me that on the day that she had communication with Loughner, like he had come over to her house several times. And anyway, she had claimed to me that he had expressed to her that he was being followed around by the FBI. And so I wasn't able to get verification of that, but just, you know, it's
well, the FBI plays a role in a whole lot of these events, like
exactly
Saraneva brothers in Boston. I mean, the FBI was right in the thick of it, covering up what happened at JFK, right there in the thick of it. So yeah. I think the FBI spends more time covering up crimes committed by the government than it does solving any crime.
Well, and also, too, I mean, you know, look at the involvement in, you know, the Oklahoma City bombing. I mean, so when she told me this, of course I wasn't going to roll my eyes. I was, you know, thinking to myself, well, how convenient.
Well, this listed a high rise. Was she across the apartment from him in a high rise?
Yeah, she claimed that she lived in the same building that he did.
So it was this building for which we have the address is 3201 West Ina Road?
Ina Road.
Ina Road.
Huh. And the phone number there, as you can see, I plugged it in and it came back with the D green results. So.
That's very good, Steph. You're doing a lot of good work.
Thank you.
I love it. This is like Dennis Camino checking out Rebecca Ross' phone number and discovering it came back from Langley.
Oh, my.
Yes.
I get a lot of friend requests on Facebook that have those places they live.
Do you now? They want to know what you're doing, Steph.
I got to screen everybody.
Absolutely.
So, well, we can turn now from here, and I'm not sure how many more are left, but shouldn't be too many more. Okay, and then this is just, you know, just saying that Jerry Lee Loeffner had pled guilty and he did not go to trial, even though originally he had pled not guilty by reason of insanity. But then at the last minute, he's guilty and away he goes. And so anyway, he was forcibly medicated in prison and his case was used as a precedent, like I said earlier, in the Washington versus Harper case. And to allow for more prisoners to be forcibly medicated. And anyway, what you see on the picture on the side there is just, you know, just a few of the PDF court documents that I've obtained following Jerry Lee Loeffner's process in the court system. Well, I would like to, you know, get those up on the government reg as well so that people can read them. And then these are different pictures. Just, you know, this presentation was really just a highlight of the case. And, you know, these are different pictures that, you know, we have of Loeffner. And I believe the one in the middle and the one on the top right and the one in the middle row on the very right, I believe that, and the bottom on the bottom right, I believe that those are really pictures of Jerry Lee Loeffner. But that's what he really looked like. And those pictures, some of those pictures have been obtained through friends that claim that Loeffner was their friend. And I did speak to someone that worked at a gas station out there as well that she spoke to me and told me that the picture that they were showing in the media wasn't Loeffner and that she was friends with them.
That's very important, Steph, right there.
It is. And I do have her name. She wasn't willing to go on video,
right?
But she did tell me that the pictures that they were showing in the media at that time was not her friend Loeffner.
Which ones were the ones they were showing? Are they among this set here?
No, it would have been the first couple pictures we showed of the crazy.
Well, the one with the hat is the one that was on the page with the gun.
Yeah, and the one on the top left, if you see the top left with
right,
the
that's close to the mugshot, right?
Yeah, that was the second mugshot released by the marshal's office. The first one was released, I believe, by Pima County Sheriff's Office. So those two photos, I believe, were definitely photoshopped. And I got a lot of people that, you know, emailed me and they're like, look, his eye, you know, he's been chipped or he's under mind control or something. But the thing is when I say Jerry Lee Loeffner is a framed patsy, you think Lee Harvey Oswald. You don't think, you know, like MK Ultra, somebody.
Well, Sirhan clearly had been hypnotized. He fired all these shots. He was in front of Bobby. Bobby was hit four times from behind. He was killed by a shot fired from about an inch and a half behind his right ear. Sirhan didn't fire any of them. There's a psychiatrist who boasted how he hypnotized Sirhan for the CIA. I mean, it's that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, and it's hard to say. I mean, Jared Lee Loeffner, it did surface that he did see a psychologist, and that psychologist died a year after the shooting. He had a special clearance with a government agency. I'm trying to think which one it is right now, but and also it was just within a week of Gabrielle Giffords and her husband Mark Kelly had put out their book following the shooting, and the co-author of the book, who was New York Times writer, he died a week before that. So the psychologist and
tell me about who died, Steph, and when.
Gabrielle Giffords and Mark Kelly wrote a book following the shooting.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember his name. Maybe I can pull it up real quick.
You're telling me the New York Times writer assisted them?
Yes. Okay, here it is. I've got it right here on my article, so I'll share it. Okay, so they had released a memoir, and it was called Gabby, A Story of Courage and Hope. And it was with co-author Jeffrey Zaslow, and he was a Jewish best-selling author and Wall Street Journalist columnist. And so he co-authored the book. His name was Jeffrey Zaslow.
Spell it.
Zaslow.
Okay.
And he suddenly died in a car accident following the release of the book.
He suddenly died in a car accident.
Right, following the release of their memoir.
A lot of weird car accidents of witnesses after JFK, may I say.
Yeah, I know. And, oh, my. So, anyway, and then I discovered that Jared Lee Loeffner had seen a psychologist, even though they claimed in the media that he was a man that went unnoticed and that if only he would have got help, if people would have noticed that he was crazy, he might have been saved. But the truth is that he got in trouble when he was a teenager, and they sent him to the juvenile system, and he saw a psychologist for a while.
See, this undermines the idea that mental health is going to save us, because here's a guy who got it, but it wasn't saved. So that runs against the story they want to peddle to the American people, so they suppress it.
Right. And then also to go along with that, the psychologist died a week after Jeffrey Zaslow died. But what is the most incriminating evidence is that this Zaslow died the same day that they presented the USS Gabrielle Giffords to Gabrielle Giffords. And they named Christina Taylor Greene's mother as the sponsor of the ship. So that's just amazing.
Well, what was the psychologist? What was the name of the psychologist who died?
The name of the psychologist, I believe, was Dr. Thomas Britton.
This is the one who is supposed to have treated Loeffner.
Right.
Well, I don't want him coming forward. We can't have someone who actually treated Loeffner.
Right.
My God, he could blow the whole case apart.
Well, and I don't even know, you know, I mean, it's hard to say, but I do know one thing about Dr. Thomas Britton is that he had a private practice in Tucson. And that he was also later, he had retired from private practice, but he was also contracted out by the Department of Defense. So he had a top clearance with the Department of Defense. So anyway, I did get an email from his son not very long ago and told me that I had made a mistake in one of my articles. I had wrote that he was a psychiatrist. And so he asked me if I would kindly change that. And so I did.
To psychologist?
Yeah. And in all my other research in my book and in everything, I had written that he was a psychologist. But in one particular article, I had accidentally wrote that he was
a psychologist. Of course, the difference is a psychiatrist can prescribe drugs and a psychologist can't.
Right. I think that is the only difference.
Well, that's a very serious difference because you have to have a higher level of training and so forth in human physiology and neurology and the like.
Right. But not for, you know, any type of hypnotism or.
No. This has to do with giving prescriptions for drugs that can affect the mind as well as the body. I mean, it's.
Yeah, exactly.
Is this the last of your slides, Stephanie?
Is it? Okay, so
no, I'm asking, is it?
I think so, maybe, yeah.
Okay. I think your slide set is superb. I love the way you set them up. Visually interesting, excellent quality. The text, just the right amount of text. I'm very impressed by all of it.
Thank you.
I'm extremely pleased to have had this opportunity to go through this with you, Steph. I think that's sensational.
Yeah, and I recommend
the name of your book again. Is it available on Amazon.com?
It's not on Amazon yet, but I have it on Lulu.com if you want a hard copy. It's called Apple Libra 11.
So is this a recent publication?
I had wrote this, I believe, in 2013, but then I revised it again. So this is a revised version. And but anyway, you can also, like I said, if anybody wants just a PDF file and read it, you know, in their little iBooks or whatever, they can just make a donation of $5 or more to thegovernmentrag.com, and I'll send them a PDF for free. So.
Well, Stephanie, I think you're doing fantastic work. I'm extremely pleased. I've learned a whole lot about the Lochner case, of which I was unaware. I'm fascinated. I can't wait to read your book. I can't thank you enough for coming on.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jim. And I am very happy to have read your book as well. And I'm looking forward to more discoveries and, you know, more information. And
Stephanie, I'm looking forward to having you back already. This is Jim Fetzer thanking my special guest for today's show, Stephanie Sledge, for being here. I recommend The Government Rag. I suggest you get a copy of her book. This, and all of you who have been watching.